Hello, and welcome to the Handcrafted Podcast. In this episode, episode 6, I've been speaking with Imogen Charleston. Now, Imogen Charleston is a ceramicist who lives on the Dorset coast in the south of England, and when she works, she likes to scour that coast looking for new types and colours of clays. It's a coastline which has a strong heritage in the pottery industry, so she's following a tradition, and she feels very tied to that tradition and ethically bound to make sure that the materials she uses are as low impact on the planet as possible. She's got a fascinating story to tell, so I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. Hi Imogen, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Thanks for agreeing to do this podcast for me.
Oh, pleasure. It's good to catch up one way or another, virtually, if not otherwise, for now.
Yeah, in these times, as we officially now have to call them.
yes, quite.
So I wanted to talk to you, Imogen, because of your crafty background, if I can put it that way. You're a ceramicist as opposed to a potter, is that correct?
Yeah. Although I'm not opposed to the term potter. I suppose ceramicist is more of a catch-all kind of umbrella for all of the things that involve the world of clay and working with clay in its many forms.
Yeah. That differs from potter because a potter just makes pots?
Yes, yeah. Traditionally speaking, I'd say a potter usually is focused on making functional ware and predominantly using the potter's wheel as well.
Right, gotcha. What they would call throwing on the great pottery throwdown that we all love so much.
Yes. Oh, have you been watching that?
Oh, it's one of the great things on telly.
I wholeheartedly agree. They certainly put them through their paces. Yeah, it's been great viewing of a Sunday evening. I'm missing it now. I don't really watch a lot of telly.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But listen, I've known you for a number of years, more years than I can count. And when we met, you were a musician. I didn't know that you were a potter or a ceramicist. Sorry, get the words right. I'm just wondering, where do you still play music?
Not at the moment. Sadly, my bass guitar and my trumpet are both sitting at home in their cases. Hopefully not feeling too lonely and forgotten, but the moment my focus is the ceramics, because it's a huge subject and something I'm really interested in and passionate about and takes up a lot of my time in a good way, in a good healthy way. Yeah,
no, that's great. Yeah, I mean, I do remember. We'll leave the music thing, but I remember that the bands that you were in were some of the all-time great musical moments that I can remember.
You're too kind.
You've been through a lot of this Bournemouth's great bands.
Yeah. Had the pleasure of performing with some wonderful people in some great venues. Yeah. Good times, good memories.
At that time, were you a ceramicist, or did that come after, or was it a parallel thing?
Well, I studied ceramics when I did my degree in 2009, graduated in 2012. So,
apologies, Imogen.
Someone is asking for your attention there.
Yeah, the doorbell rang and the dog got attention. Let me ask that again. Sorry. So when you were playing music and being the journeywoman of the trumpet around town, were you also a ceramicist then, or did that come after?
That was later. So yeah, I've been a hobby musician for many years, and dabbled in various different things musically. And I went to university and did an applied arts degree in 2009. So I graduated from that in 2012. And so that kind of rekindled my interest in ceramics. But I had previously worked with clay and done a variety of different things creatively. I was also part of a touring theatre company called the Paper Cinema, and I was a puppeteer with them. So we did a form of live animation and live music, and had the absolute joy of touring the world with that for a couple of years. And they're still going, but I kind of stepped back from that because I felt like I wanted to return to my passion around ceramics, because it offers so much. It's just endless possibilities, and I'm really enjoying kind of exploring that. So hence why the music has taken a bit of a sideline or back on the back burner at the moment, and the main focus is definitely the clay and all things clay.
I mean, that's, I remember the Paper Cinema. They were and are a fantastic theatrical show.
Yeah, truly.
It seems like your entire world is creative, which is, the reason I say that is because so many creatives have to supplement themselves, especially right now, with other things. Are you finding right now that you're able to maintain yourself being creative, or do you have to scrub floors at Tesco's and things like that?
I'm really fortunate that I am in a position at the moment where I am okay. So as well, as well as making my own work, I teach, and that's kind of my main job now. Previously, I used to have a part-time job as an electronics assembly person, and that was kind of my bread and butter. But I dropped that a couple of years ago now, and so moved into focusing on teaching and then making on the side. So at the moment, I'm in a position where I'm able to just focus on my own work, and I'm making reasonable progress with things. Things take a lot longer than you think they're going to, generally in life, and I think especially with ceramics, there's a lot of processes involved.
I'd forgotten actually that you were an electronics engineer. I remember we had a situation, you and me and our friend Dr. Ben, where you had to get a Citroën 2CV started in the French countryside.
Oh yeah, yes, I recall that. Yeah.
You rewired the ignition.
yeah. Well, I think Ben did most of it, but yeah, it was definitely a little bit of teamwork involved in that. But it's certainly, I think there is an element of creativity within engineering and that sort of process, that sort of fault finding and diagnosis aspect of things. And I think the attention to detail as well. There's a lot of things that I certainly carried through into ceramics, and it's very handy, you know, having a kiln, which is an electronic device, if it goes wrong, which it does, being able to repair that is definitely useful.
Yeah, very useful. Electrics and me don't see eye to eye at all. One of the things that you have been doing in recent years, which I found really interesting, but have only spied from a distance, is working with clays that you find along the Jurassic coast.
Yeah.
What? There are so many questions here. I guess what inspired it, it would be my first one.
Well, it's a lot of things, really. I mean, my love of the outdoors generally is certainly one. I've always taken an interest and an enjoyment from being outside. We're really lucky. It's a beautiful part of the world, and might sound slightly biased, but I mean, I think it's just got such a diversity of landscape and animal life that just, yeah, it's just endlessly fascinating. And any walk along the coastline just offers so much. So I think that's certainly part of it. And also, I went on a glaze chemistry workshop with Suzette Knight, actually, our other fellow ceramicist, a few years ago with Linda Bloomfield. And that was kind of a real door-opening moment for me, I think, because when I did my degree, we didn't really cover much of the kind of chemistry behind ceramics so much as more of the processes and the making techniques and things like that. So, yeah, it just sort of fascinated me, and this kind of realization that I'm working with materials from the earth that are millions of years old is just astounding, really, you know, and that whole transformation that they go through, taking rocks and things. I mean, a lot of the stuff that you work with, you know, when you start off with ceramics, you're buying things in from suppliers and it's in a bag and it's labeled and you don't necessarily think about it. You know, you just go, okay, you read a book, gives you a recipe and it says, okay, use these materials, mix them together and you've got a glaze that will look this colour. But when you start to kind of go down to the kind of, I don't know, the chemical level of it and actually understand what those minerals are, then and then realize that they're all around you as well. Yeah, it's just really exciting. And yeah, going back to where we live as well, we are very lucky here that there is a huge amount of clay around the Jurassic coast.
So yeah, it's interesting you should say Suzette, who is also featuring on this podcast. I'm actually drinking tea right now from a mug of hers. We did a swap where I made her a silver ring and she made me a mug, which was really nice.
That's a good trade.
it was a really good trade. Yeah, I use it every single day, so it was great for me. It was interesting you were saying about the different landscapes around when you were talking about those Jurassic clays. Mm. Do you find that there are different types and textures and colours as you go along the coast, and how does it compare to the commercial clays that you might buy?
So commercial clays are still, you know, the same stuff. The difference is with them is that they are processed. So a manufacturer will mix several different clays together to get certain properties out of it. So something, for example, like a stoneware clay for making tableware that fires to a higher temperature will have a different blend of raw materials in it to somebody just trying to phone me. Commercial clays, yeah. So commercial clays that you buy in from a supplier, they're still from the ground, from clay pits. The difference is that they're blended together to have certain properties. So, for example, a stoneware clay that you use for tableware that needs to fire to a higher temperature will have a different mix of raw materials to, say, a porcelain clay. So what you find when you're collecting wild clay is that, yeah, it varies a lot. And along the coast here, we've got some really high-quality clay, actually, what they call ball clay. It was actually, years ago, the foundations of a lot of the potteries around the area. So if you think back to pool pottery, that was founded here because of the high grade of clay that we have in the area. And even, I think, Wedgwood actually shipped several thousand tons of clay back along into the factories there so that they could produce their versions of porcelain clays that they were working on at the time. So you've got that sort of, and that's a very white, pure clay. And then moving along the coast, sort of if you go towards the Barton Beds, that's another large clay deposit and an area of scientific interest. You get a lot of fossils and things there as well. And the clay there has got a lot of iron oxide in it, so it's a redder clay. And yeah, they behave slightly differently as well. So it's interesting sort of learning about each different clay. So there's a lot of process that you have to go through as well when you're working with wild clays. A lot of testing, checking what firing temperatures it needs to go to, and all this kind of technical stuff, I suppose, that you need to kind of know, familiarise yourself with the materials you're working with as best you can. There's always an element of the unknown when you're working with clay.
So do you think you need to be quite knowledgeable before you start working with that kind of clay? Or is it something that you could just go pick up off the ground and have a go?
Absolutely, yeah. No, you don't need any experience whatsoever to go and find clay. I think pretty much everybody would have probably at some point been out on a walk somewhere and found some clay on the ground, that kind of extra sticky mud, or, you know, gardeners very familiar with it as well when they're digging beds and things like that. So thinking back to when people started working with clay goes back quite a few thousand years. I know that they found pots and totems that were made at least 20 to 25,000 years ago. And I'm sure it dates back before then because it's, you know, a huge part of the Earth's crust. So, yeah, you don't need any experience to go and make a pot from the ground.
So when you put it like that, your craft is one of the oldest in time.
Yeah, which is quite humbling in a way, you know, when you think about trying things out and exploring new ideas and wondering, you know, obviously things evolve and change over time, but that the fundamentals of it are essentially the same. You're taking this material from the ground, molding it into the shape you want, and then firing it. And the firing process is exciting as well, really. That's the kind of alchemy of it, where you're taking this soft, malleable material, which was also rock at one point in time, many millions of years ago, that's become a soft material again, and then firing it to turn it back into a solid material.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating thing. It's one of the great things that I've learned through the TV show is that the alchemy of putting things onto the clay and not really knowing 100% what you're going to get back from it.
Yeah, me too. I think that's why it's, you know, it keeps pulling me back and pretty much any other ceramicist as well. You know, it's that constant exploration of material and process, as well as ideas too. And the playfulness that you can get from experimenting with things. You can, yeah, stick things in the clay and yes, like you said, you know, you might have an idea of how certain materials are going to behave, but it doesn't always turn out that way. And sometimes you get some very beautiful outcomes from those kind of experiments, and sometimes things that you think are a mistake can be quite wonderful, actually. So it's, yeah.
I have a similar experience when I'm making the jewelry in the way that I do, because I reticulate the silver a lot, which is basically you heat it up to the point where it's just starting to melt and you can see the ripples, and you take the heat away and you can't predict the patterns that it will leave, but you get some really lovely almost like moonscapes on the top of the silver. It's lovely.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, because I have to say now, yeah, that some of the pieces that I've seen of yours, the reticulated ones, I think are the ones that I like the most personally. Yeah, because there's that interest in the surface texture. So that's really interesting to know how that's done. But also, yeah, known, but yeah, that certain element of uncertainty in it is exciting.
It's uncertainty, and you also have to be quite aware, because there's a fine line between beautiful surface and blob of silver.
yeah, there is. Yeah, sure.
One of the things that you're passionate about, this links up, I think, quite nicely. One of the things that you're passionate about, as well as the clay, is environmentalism. And I noticed while I was scanning through your website, it reminded me that you've done, I guess, what you would call a study in environmentalism. You've kind of used litter and things you found on the beach, rubbish, as a form. It seems like they're almost installations, protest installations. Is that what that is intended as?
Yeah. So yeah, the environment and humans' interaction with it, with regards to litter and things like that. Certainly, yeah, it's always been a source of inspiration. And previously, before I started working with the local native materials, I was working a lot more with porcelain and, yeah, slip casting, which is a technique where you use liquid clay and you pour it into a mould. So the moulds I was making were from litter that I'd found, predominantly things like plastic bottles. They're a bit easier to cast than other materials. It's quite a solid form. And then transforming those objects, and I quite liked this, the concept of putting something that you consider to be trash and then transforming it through the material. So porcelain, you think of, you know, as your kind of fine dining, you know, your tableware. And then also putting that in a gallery space as well, you know, that whole thing about perceived value, how someone can so easily take a bottle, which is, you know, plastic, which is made out of oil, essentially, you know, still a finite resource, really shouldn't just be chucking it all over the place, but also, transforming it into something that maybe has more value to the viewer. And I kind of moved away from that and started to look into other ways I could just connect people with their environment. Something that I think is probably one of the positive things out of the last year, actually, and through the lockdown, is people spending more time in their local environment and going for walks and just being a bit more observant about the journey, you know, the walk that they're taking, rather than using it as a means to get from one place to another. And I really like that. And that's something that that kind of definitely kind of feeds into what I've been doing now, using these locally sourced materials and having that element of sustainability as well. You know, there's a lot of materials in ceramics, the cobalt, for example, which is mined in the Congo. And, you know, the idea of using that, or, I mean, it's a beautiful blue colour, but, you know, that I could find something that I can use that's on my doorstep, you know, that kind of sustainability. And then sharing that with people as well, you know, to kind of say, look, you know, there's this object that's been made from things in your local landscape. And I think that's a really important message, to kind of bring back that sense of, yeah, connection with your local community and landscape.
There's a lot that I want to explore in what you've just said. Firstly, the fact that you've taken what your craft, and rather than turn it into a commercial thing that you can sell on your website, you've turned it into an installation that is purely for artistic and to provoke thought. I think that really defines you as an artist as well as a ceramicist. I guess it goes back to what I said right at the beginning. Everything you do seems to be focused into some kind of artistic pursuit, which I find really interesting. And it would be lovely to see those things in galleries, you know, as a statement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think with anything like that, the more people you can reach through any means is a good thing, you know, just to get a conversation starter, I suppose, you know, just the idea of of people considering things a little bit more and just being a bit more mindful and aware of their impact on the world.
Yeah, I agree. And that leads me on to the other part of what you said, which is about people getting out and about and seeing their environment. And you and I know, living where we do, that when the summer comes, you'll go to the beach in an evening and the tourists will have left and they leave their rubbish everywhere, which I think is what inspired what you did with that project.
Yes, yes.
And there is a lot of hope in my mind that people will have made that connection, and especially local people. You know, I mean, the tourists come down from wherever they come and they go away and they leave stuff because they don't see the value of it. But hopefully the local people will start to see the value. I've certainly had a go at kids on the beach who were left litter.
Good for you.
They didn't like it. It was a weird one. We were standing on the pier and I watched someone with one of those so-called reusable Sainsbury's bags or whatever the supermarket was, one of those reusable bags.
Yeah.
He poured his rubbish onto the beach and took the bag away.
Wow.
Walked past the bins to get off of the beach. And it's just, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, the mind boggles, doesn't it?
Yeah. So what goes through your mind?
What goes through your mind when you do that?
Do you have any other local environmental activism or any involvement, or is that your kind of sole focus in that respect?
This is now. I have in the past, I set up Plastic Free Bournemouth, which initially was just an online sort of social media presence, partly to kind of vent my frustrations and observations of things, and then also to again start up a conversation and try and share some inspiration, some ideas, or you know, have a discussion around how people might do things differently, how to encourage people to use a bin on the beach, for example. We had a few people involved for a while. Some wonderful volunteers have helped along the last few years, and we did some big beach clean events and things like that, as well as working with the local council on the seafront team, who are amazing and do a fantastic job of magicking everything away so it looks like a pristine beach at the beginning of each day. And they set up a few different things, like a beach toy borrow box, which we worked with them on, which is just basically recycling leftover beach toys that they'd collected from the beach each day and putting them into a box for people to use, so they don't have to buy a single-use beach toy and they can borrow one for the day. So yeah, there's a lot of things that have sort of like been left as a legacy for that. And now that's kind of taken, again, that's another thing that's taken a bit of a back seat. And so I'm focusing that energy into my ceramics now and trying to use that as a vessel, excuse the pun, to talk about
good ones.
just happened. So yeah, to use that as a way of talking around the kind of environmental issues instead.
I remember you setting that up and I thought it was a great thing at the time. And really, it takes a special kind of person to actually get off their ass and do it, doesn't it? Your other work, I was looking at some of your other ceramics on your website. And one of the interesting things that you play with is putting lots of different textures and styles into a single piece. So there's lots of smooth and glazed alongside rough and raw. Is that something you would call your style, or is that a phase that you're going through on a journey?
it's yeah, good question. It's interesting. Yeah, it's probably both. It's my style for now, I think. I find that my sort of preferred aesthetic changes and evolves constantly, as it's an informed process by the work that I'm making at the time. Often things evoke different ideas out of, so you can start off with a bowl, for example, and have an idea, right, okay, I want to glaze it with these colors and put this texture on it. And then once you know that happens, then you start to evolve and kind of develop the techniques. So I'm really into incising surfaces. So that's where you have the leather hard clay, so clay that's slightly dry, and then you carve it, kind of like you'd carve wood, I suppose, but not with a chisel, just with a little hand tool. And that's I really like the tactile finish that provides, that with the juxtaposition with the glazed surface as well. But it's something that I find does constantly evolve. So each piece I make, I kind of develop the technique a little bit more or change the shape a little bit, and then sometimes the shapes don't always come out how you think they are going to once they're fired, because the whole process is kind of, although I might develop ideas in a sketchbook and things like that, and I've got test samples of glazes, sometimes things change along the way. The clay shrinks, for example, between 10-15% from start to finish, and various things can affect the way a glaze comes out. So a firing temperature, if it doesn't reach the temperature that the glaze matures at, for example, a glaze could end up being matte rather than shiny. And so each time things like that happen, that kind of feeds back in to the work. It's interesting, you have an idea of what you want to achieve, and then sometimes something informs it and you think, oh, actually, I want to take it down that path for a while now.
It's that kind of understanding that makes it even more impressive when people can just do the same thing over and over again and get the same results just by understanding those little temperature changes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think there's that refining of process as well. I mean, say take Suzette's work, for example. I absolutely love her surface patina. It's just gorgeous, and her use of really vibrant colors and texture involved in that. And that's something, she's been refining that kind of surface pattern for years, and it's really exciting to see kind of how it's going to turn out. The next batch of work that she produces, how will it have evolved from the previous one?
Yeah, and the use of metal staples to hold the folds together. Yeah, I love it as well. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I've got just a couple more questions, Imogen. The first one is, what are you doing now? Where can people find you? And when they find you, what are you doing? So teaching, etc. So why don't you let people know?
Okay. So, So as I was saying back at the beginning, teaching is kind of has been my kind of main staple of work alongside my making. And that's something that I'm really looking forward to getting back to, partly because it's a pleasure to teach people pottery. It's really fun watching somebody take a lump of mud and make something. And hopefully I'll be able to open the doors soon.
Can people book that now?
People can. At the moment, I've just put provisional dates out, as we're all kind of sitting on the edge of our seats, waiting to see what happens at the end of the month. So hopefully, come April, I'll be opening the classes to book live. So if anyone was interested, you can find out moonstudioceramics.co.uk. And all of the classes are listed there. So I offer classes for all abilities, so you don't need any previous experience. And yeah, hopefully classes will commence from May.
Cool. And your website, you've also got some of the things that we've been talking about for people to see as well and to buy, in fact.
Yes. Yeah, so my own site is imogencharleston.co.uk. And yeah, you can find out a little bit more about me there. I have also just started to dabble in the world of blog writing. So we'll see how I go with that. So the next one I'm going to write about is building my Raku kiln. Because that was quite...
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, that was a really interesting project. And yeah, a success. I have a Raku kiln now, which I'm hoping to get out and use again soon.
That's great. You should probably explain what Raku is, because if I try, it won't be good. But I do love watching the results of Raku.
Yeah, so basically it's a process that originated in Japan. It's evolved slightly from the traditional method, but you heat up pots very quickly in a gas-fired kiln, and then when they reach a temperature of around about 1,000 degrees centigrade, you take off the lid, take out the red-hot pots, and then plunge them into materials, combustible materials, so wood chips and things like that. And depending on the materials in the glazes and things, you can get some really great reactions. And it's all very theatrical and exciting, and it's one of the highlights on that show on the telly as well when they do it. and then you take your red hot pots once they've been in the combustible materials and plunge them into cold water. So you break all of the rules that you normally do with ceramics, you know, treating things with care, and you're just chucking it from one extreme temperature to another. But yeah, with the reward of some wonderful surface finishes on that. So, and yeah, and very exciting as well.
Is that one of the classes you can sign up to on your website?
Yes, it will be. It will be, yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, I might sign up myself.
Yeah, do it. Come on over and yeah, chuck some hot pots in some wood and see what happens.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. I really hope you enjoyed listening to Imogen's story, and I hope you agree that it is quite fascinating to hear the things that she does and the way she works. She's told you her website. I'll also put that in the description of this podcast, so you'll be able to go over there and hopefully sign up for one of her courses. Maybe I'll see you on the Raku course myself. Next week, I'll be speaking with Mitch Pendergast, who makes wire sculptures and creative little arty things from his studio down in Cornwall. So keep an ear out for that one. If you're interested to know who did the music for this podcast, it was the wonderful Lou Davis. So I'll put a link to her Facebook into the description of the podcast. Just one last thing. I've got a Buy Me a Coffee page set up for this podcast. And if you like the podcast and you'd like to support it and help it keep going, please do go over there and make a little donation. You don't have to, there's no obligation, but if you feel the urge and you think you'd like to support what I'm doing, I'd be very grateful. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you can make it back next week.